I braced myself, waiting for the hot lead to tear through me. How much would it hurt? Would I die instantly, or would I endure the torment of surgeons, infections, and a slow, painful death?
On this episode of Dead Man's Hand, we provide you another free chapter of the audiobook. This chapter returns to the present, where the narrator follows Hickok as he flees vengeful assassins in Abilene, Kansas, and boards a train out of town. Instead of escape, Hickok and Thomas find themselves in a trap, a packed train car blocked by hired guns.
The relentless shake and rattle of steel on steel pulled me deeper into a canyon where the only light flickered from the moon's outline in the sky, behind which heaven shone. Yet, the train continued its journey into darkness until we entered a tunnel that swallowed all light. As we emerged, I was blinded, not by the sun, but by a flash from a cannon or possibly thousands of pounds of TNT, jolting every muscle in my body and shattering my dream. It was Hickok, shaking my shoulder and looking down at me with bloodshot eyes as the sun streamed through the train car window.
Thomas, he whispered, you need to get your wits about you right now.
Though I responded to Hickok's prodding, my thoughts had yet to separate the events of the previous night and my current situation. How long had I been on this train? How did I get on it? To clear away the fog of fatigue and sleep deprivation, I recounted the events of the past 24 hours. It felt as if I had never left the train since departing New York. I had spent just one night in Abilene, Kansas, spending most of it keeping track of Hickok's early childhood account while remaining acutely aware of every creak and noise outside our hotel door as the saloon downstairs bumped and bustled with activity until around 3 a.m. Yet Hickok showed no signs of sleep last night. He shuffled and dealt cards, teaching me the rules and tricks of gambling while recounting significant events from his life, including his family's struggles with the Underground Railroad and the loss of his father. I drifted off several times as Hickok spoke. Eventually, I abandoned my notes, opting instead to listen and play cards until daylight broke and overpowered the lantern's glow, at which point we gathered our things to catch the first train out of town.
Where are we going?
I asked as soon as we had left the hotel room. I hadn't considered the destination, or whether I had enough money to extend my trip, or make it back in time for my mother's birthday.
New York,
he replied.
Really?
I responded, astonished. It was the perfect situation. I couldn't have planned it any better.
What's in New York for you?
An opportunity.
Hickok led me through the hotel, cautious at every turn, one hand occupied with his bag and the other poised to draw his pistol at the slightest hint of danger. As we exited the hotel, he instructed me to walk ahead so he could watch my back. I thought we were safe on the train and fell asleep almost instantly until he woke me. I glanced around but only saw passengers trying to either sleep or arouse each other with the words freshly printed on the newspapers as they were being served coffee and tea, stirring my own thirst and hunger. How long have I been sleeping? I asked, sitting up in my seat and stretching my back only to be reminded of my unideal posture.
A few minutes,
Hickok answered. I thought I'd been asleep for hours, my body so deprived that it found solace in unconsciousness despite its discomfort. What's the matter? I asked, seeing nothing alarming.
It looks like we're hemmed in by Phil Coe's associates on either side of this train car,
Hickok said, alarmed but calm.
I assume they will try to ambush us simultaneously. It's their only move.
Who are you talking about?
I asked, baffled at how I had become a target. It was one thing to be caught in crossfire, another to be gunned down in cold blood. I could see the tension in Hickok's jaw. He had been sitting with his back against the window the entire time, scanning for any sign of movement. His expression shifted slightly at my fear. Two men caught his attention to our right, laughing as they harassed an older couple across from them.
Those cowboys are in on it.
Dressed in dusty, worn-out denim and flannel shirts, the cowboys pounded their boots against the wooden floor. One of them with pumpkin-colored hair swapped his Stetson for the elderly gentleman's bowler hat. The other, sporting a full beard and a wide-brimmed sombrero that cast a shadow over his face, laughed and raised a bottle to his lips before shouting,
You look like a real dandy, Red.
Red removed the short-rimmed hat and extended it to the old man, who tried to take it, but Red shoved it into his face. Snatching his own hat back, Red threw a lasso around a woman in the aisle, causing her to shriek, while her male companion threw it off and confronted the cowboy.
You got a problem, mister?
Red sneered as he pulled his pistol from its holster and pressed it against the man's gut. The man immediately retreated to his seat as I simmered in silent anger.
Settle down,
Hickok said, noticing my flinch.
This is just a distraction to expose my back to the others.
I turned to see two men at the other end of the train car, their eyes fixed on Hickok. One was tall and broad-shouldered, clad in a dark wool frock coat. A black bowler hat shadowed his waxed mustache, sharp jawline, and penetrating black eyes, which now locked onto me with unsettling intensity. Next to him sat a leaner man with a goatee and wearing a charcoal gray tailcoat, tailored to accentuate his slender frame. Hickok was right. They weren't interested in the cowboys disturbing the passengers, but in the reactions from either Hickok or me.
You all are a bunch of lily-livered cowards,
Red exclaimed, scanning the suddenly silent passengers who avoided eye contact and clutched their belongings tightly. The two cowboys seemed to revel in the unease they created, enjoying their temporary power over the subdued crowd. Finally, Red's gaze landed on Hickok, and I anticipated Hickok's lightning-fast draw, expecting him to shoot the cowboy dead before Red could lose his grip on the hatred fueled by Wild Bill's steady stare. But nothing happened. Red exchanged glances with the two well-dressed men at the end of the car. Receiving no response, he returned his pistol to its holster and sat back down.
Ko's men are scared. No one wants to make a move,
Hickok whispered. What are you going to do? I asked, contemplating my role in this unfolding drama. Hickok's stoic gaze remained unwavering.
Be ready to hit the floor, but I'm going to call their bluff.
He paused, eyeing the other passengers who the cowboys were harassing.
If I can prevent the use of gunfire, I will.
Do you have an extra gun? I can cover you, I suggested reluctantly.
The words escaped me before I fully realized what I was saying, but I was determined not to be the reason Hickok was killed. At this moment, I prefer death to cowardice.
Do you know how to shoot?
He asked, narrowing his eyes.
Of course, I replied, though the truth stung. I had only shot a gun twice, once at 14 with my father, who taught me to defend myself with our household pistol, and once with friends blasting an old cabin for fun with shotguns. Neither experience involved precision or moving targets.
Hickok handed me a small derringer. If the size of the gun represented his trust in me, I felt insulted. But he seemed just as intent on keeping people safe as he was on neutralizing the threat.
Use this to protect yourself in case they pull you into this,
he said. You can only take two of them at a time,
I pointed out, foolishly giving the master gunfighter advice.
Let me guard your back. I won't shoot. I'll just distract them. If I need to pull this, I will.
Hickok smiled, his eyes glistening with emotion.
I like you, Thomas. You're a good kid, but I don't want to see another young man with his whole life ahead of him buried because of me.
If he aimed to dissuade me from protecting him, his words had the opposite effect.
I'm going to protect you with my life, Mr. Hickok. Maybe I'll fail, but you can't stop me from doing what's right.
Hickok's face darkened, his emotion vanishing and every muscle tensing as he pulled down his wide-brimmed hat. He stood, shrinking the height of the train and strode down the aisle to the left, passing passengers who were jolted from their petrified withdrawal. I stood with my hand on the derringer in my pocket, not out of bravery or a desire to latch myself to the legend of Wild Bill, but because I had committed to my words and accepted the first consequence of my integrity. The cowboys noticed Hickok's movement, their eyes widening as they saw me approach. They wore the faces of men who had forgotten long ago the meaning of life and the value of anything that did not stuff their appetites for pleasure. And in their eyes, I was already dead. I heard Hickok's footsteps tramping in the opposite direction, beelining for the well-dressed assassins. The cowboys in front of me scrambled out of their drunken stupor. What could I do but rush them? As they sprang to their feet, I crashed into both of them, guns in hand, hearing the breath explode from Red, the manure dust of his last cattle trail filling my nostrils. We fell to the ground, and they fumbled to push me off. I seized Red's gun and hurled it down the aisle. At this point, passengers gasped and screamed but did not intervene. A gunshot rang out from the other end of the train car, silencing everything, even halting the struggle of the cowboys I had momentarily subdued. This gave me enough time to stand and draw the Derringer from my pocket, aiming it at them. The cowboy with a full-sized beard pushed himself off of Red and stood, laughing at my weapon.
"Is that what you brought to this gunfight?"
he jeered. Before I could react, Red slapped the pocket pistol from my hand.
"Move so I can shoot him,"
shouted the bearded one. I braced myself, waiting for the hot lead to tear through me. How much would it hurt? Would I die instantly, or would I endure the torment of surgeons, infections, and a slow, painful death? Before I could respond, Hickok's voice thundered from behind them, cutting through their bravado.
"Have a seat, Thomas."
His tone was authoritative, and I complied, stepping aside as he advanced, both of his Navy Colt 36s drawn and aimed directly at the two cowboys. The cowboys' confidence faltered, and they looked up to face Hickok, his presence dominating the narrow aisle.
"You're on the wrong train,"
he said, his voice steady and low. They exchanged glances, uncertainty flickering in their eyes. He stepped closer, the twin Colts blinding in the sun's gleam. The cowboys shared nervous looks, their confidence dissipating under Hickok's unwavering gaze.
"We were just having a bit of fun with this greenhorn,"
the bearded one stammered, attempting to regain some composure. Hickok spat on the cowboy's boot, his mouth clenched voice with disdain.
"Do you know what I think is fun?"
The cowboys lifted their hands in front of them, presenting an inadequate barrier between the imminent bullets and the flesh of their torsos. They looked at each other, contemplating their fate.
"Your friends are waiting for you. Now just walk through that door behind you and jump."
Reluctantly, the two cowboys backed toward the cabin door.
"Let's get out of here,"
the red-haired one muttered.
"Better than getting shot."
Hickok followed them out the door, his pistols unwavering, until we could hear their distant shouts fade. As Hickok returned, relief washed over me, and the train car erupted into applause.
"Nice work, Wild Bill,"
a woman shouted.
Hickok tipped his hat.
"Sorry for the disturbance, folks."
"I knew they were scoundrels,"
said a man nearby.
"I thought they were going to rob us."
"Not with Wild Bill on the train,"
called another passenger from a few rows up.
"We're safe from train robbers on this trip. Not even the James gang would dare challenge Wild Bill."
"Did you shoot the other two?" I asked when we returned to our seats and were instantly attended to by a waiter. "I heard gunfire."
Hickok chuckled.
"The first man jumped out the door himself with a little encouragement, but the other fellow didn't want to go down without a fight. He tried to draw his gun on me, but I caught his hand and lifted it, and he put a hole in the ceiling. He wasn't much trouble after that, but I didn't give him the courtesy of jumping."
I had forgotten I was still holding the Derringer, clinging to it subconsciously to soothe my rattled nerves. Hickok took it from me and tucked it into his vest pocket. I sat back and breathed deeply, a hollow feeling remaining in my stomach.
"I appreciate the help,"
Hickok said.
"I'm getting too old for this."
As I looked out the window, the landscape rushed by, a blur of green and brown, the world moving on as if nothing had happened. But I knew better. I was forever changed by this moment, feeling a dose of courage from Wild Bill by mere proximity, as if courage was as infectious as a disease. In the next half hour, several passengers approached Hickok to thank him personally, including train employees who treated us to the best food and drinks on the menu. Hickok politely tipped his hat to everyone who approached, many of whom turned red or stuttered before staring too long and returning to their seats.
"That was a mighty brave thing you did, young man,"
a lady said. I hadn't looked up when her compliment was met with silence. Hickok tapped my foot. I looked up from my steak, mouth half full and agape, realizing she was addressing me.
"I didn't do anything," I said, covering my mouth with my napkin. "I'd be dead if not for Wild Bill."
The woman was in her late 50s or early 60s, her bun perfectly set atop her head, a shawl pinned neatly at the top like a windless sail.
"I certainly feared for my life,"
she said.
"Those cowboys were harassing my husband as soon as we sat on the train, and I just prayed to the Lord Almighty that he inspire someone to stand up to them."
"It was nothing, ma'am. I knew my own life was in good hands."
After the supporters emptied their hearts of gratitude, I turned to Hickok, hoping the appreciation had alleviated his guilt-ridden conscience to some degree. He was gazing out the window, rotating a loose deck of cards in his hand without breaking the pile.
"People will always need brave men like you," I said. Hickok smirked.
That wasn't brave. What you did with that Derringer was brave.
You're mocking me, I said, though I was hardly insulted having survived my first showdown with paid killers. He turned to set the cards down and poured himself a drink from a new bottle of whiskey that had been gifted to us.
I'm not mocking you. I don't say anything to make someone feel better. It's the truth. You had no business facing off against those cowboys who would have cut you down if they weren't dead drunk.
I was lucky and scared to death, I admitted, leaning in. All I could do was run into them.
That's why it was brave. You were scared, yet you acted anyway. It's not the same for me. I don't scare. Not easily, anyway. It's just how the good Lord made me. Bravery can get you killed, right or wrong. Real bravery is settling on the prairie, where loneliness and starvation will kill you before anything else. I'm not brave, Thomas. But I've protected brave men and families for as long as the people allowed me.
I noticed the ambient conversation had nearly vanished as passengers listened to Hickok's reflections on his career as a lawman.
I don't think it has to be over, Mr. Hickok, I said. Every lawman makes mistakes.
What else do you want to know, Thomas? What part of my story do you feel needs the reckoning of truth from my early life?
I set down my utensils, abandoning the rest of my plate, and took out my pen, pad, and bottle of ink. I found the page where I had stopped writing and read the last thing I'd written. Why didn't you just follow Oliver out west after your father died? Hickok looked back out the window, drank a shot of whiskey, and winced at the burn of 90-proof alcohol in regret.
Despite what you and the rest of the world might think of me, I was a good boy. When father died, we sold the farm and moved to Homer, where I attended school for the first time in my life for 2 years. I was miserable. I could already read and write, but mother wanted me to get educated and find a path that didn't depend on a rifle. She did her best. But by the time I was 18, I had had enough. I craved adventure. I needed wide open spaces. I needed to be in a place where my skills with a gun, my strength, and my wits were valued. But I also needed to support myself. I needed money.
Is that when you left to work for the Illinois and Michigan Canal?
It sounds like you've done your homework like a good journalist.
That must have been difficult work.
A job is a job. If you choose it, there must be something tolerable for you. It's bad men who make jobs difficult. For me, that man was Charles Hudson.
So we hope that you enjoy these sample chapters. And if you actually sign up for our newsletter, we will give you access to chapters as they come out, and we hope that you're able to leave us an honest review when the novel does debut, and we appreciate your support.